I'm going to get myself wired here, legally. My goodness, what a an amazing story there. My name is Damon, and I am an alcoholic. You get it pretty clear that what it means for me when I say I'm an alcoholic is alcohol is not my problem. You know, whatever it was that made me restless, irritable, and discontent. That's the way Bill talks about we had to get down to causes and conditions, you know. And I'm going to cover just a little bit about how I got here, a little bit about my background. But I'm going to try something I've been kind of interested in doing. I found out that when I started practicing the traditions in my life, that my wife got a whole lot better. And the people around me got a whole lot better. And I've come to really fall in love with the traditions. And there seems to be a lot of sobriety in here. And I want to talk about it not from the theoretical, but how it actually works in my life and to practice those. And I want to weave it in a little bit with my story. So I'm actually kind of interested in what I have to say tonight, too, because I really don't know. And that is so much the beauty of this program, is that I don't have to think about it. I haven't been really dwelling on it a lot, you know. But just that I'd like to kind of carry it that way because of what those traditions have meant to me. So a little bit of background. I guess I need to qualify, make sure that we might have the same disease here. But I was born in Georgia Baptist Hospital in 1955, so coming up on 59 years in November, so. And lived down in East Point for a few years, in fact, till I was about 7 or 8. And when I was down there at 6 years old, now I had a pull your pants down club with a girl down the street, and she and I were the only two members of the club. I was also going back behind my house was Earl Milliron's house. Now it was a nice little neighborhood, and there was this gravel road that went back behind the junkyard that had the old junk cars and stuff. And Earl Milliron, their family moved a whole house back there on a house trailer. It was a fascinating thing to watch for a little five-year-old or whatever. But they also had a cigarette machine out behind the concrete block building, and the cigarettes were 35 cents a pack. And the machine wasn't guarded all that well, so we could sort of sneak up there, you know, put our 35 cents in and get a pack. Now, we'd had to have stolen the money, of course, you know. So I started out kind of young by what I call my MO, which is pleasure by sneaking around. Is there anybody else here that got pleasure by sneaking around? You know, that idea that if I could get away with it, then it was okay, you know. And now I tell you what, I wasn't too bright, because I remember getting a spanking just about every time I went out and smoked one of those cigarettes. And we didn't have the cigarette, then we'd roll up some rabbit tobacco. Anybody ever done the rabbit tobacco out there? Yeah, that's some harsh stuff, But anyway, we moved up to Cobb County back in 1964. But I'll tell you what, I'm a guy who came up in a family that I got no excuses, you know. I really don't. My dad, when he decided to take a traveling job in 1963, I remember him asking me if it was okay, you know. Some very loving parents. I got two older sisters, and I actually got pictures of me dressed in a nurse's uniform at 5 or 6 years old, that I was like their little doll or something. But we moved up to Marietta, and in my first year in elementary school up there, I had some behavioral problems. This was back when they actually could do the paddle, you know, and you go in the principal's office, and it was hanging on the wall, you know. They decorated them. I don't know why you want to decorate something you're going to hit somebody with, but anyway, I got that a couple of times, and my parents said, there's something going on here, and they took me to a child psychologist, and they said, he's bored. Anybody else here have problems with that, getting bored? Ooh, man, that's a dangerous thing for me. I get too creative when I get bored. So they sent me to a private school down on West Paces Ferry Road. Now, in this neighborhood we were in, we were probably one of the first 10 houses in the neighborhood. So as the kids moved in, I was sort of the ringleader there. But down at this other school, I was very much bullied. I was absolutely the bottom of the rung. And there was a guy there who actually made it. His joy in life, in a lot of ways, was just to give me trouble, you know. And... It's one of those things, you know, they say the alcoholic leads a double life, you know. And also, I was one of those guys who had a lot of potential if he only applied himself. Anybody else here, you know, been told that one? So I think it was about 8 or 9 years old, there was a guy down the street, and he introduced me to the magic of making model airplanes, and it was the glue that was the first thing that he was interested in. And my sister, I was about 10 years old, she turned me on to marijuana as a step up, you know. Then at 12 years old, there was a few of us, we all got some of the clear liquor and we put it all in the Sprite bottle. We got the color liquor and we put that in a Coke bottle, all from the different, you know. Of course, I was the one who had, I was kind of the ringleader there. Yeah, I mean, we even had a 3-story treehouse behind my house, you know, and had 3 sections, and we even had a place we could drive the bicycles up on the bottom, you know. And of course, we had stolen all the wood from all the building, you know, houses being built around. And when the guy who was the builder came by and looked, we said our parents bought it all. And when our parents asked, we told them the builder got it, you know. So I started out with having a little bit of a, well, I didn't have a difficulty with honesty. I just didn't see the point, you know, and that it didn't really apply to me. I like people to be honest with me, but if I needed to, you know, I could lie. So I'm going through high school, you know, and starting to get, I was a child of the 60s. Anybody else here? They say if you remember the 60s, you weren't really there. I mean, I was on a, I used to hitchhike down to the Strip in Atlanta and got into a riot down there. I used to, you know, hang out there. But there was always some booze involved in it, you know. And then somewhere in the late part of my high school, I decided to stop smoking, and I found out that the friends who were there in the circle disappeared except one or two. It's one of those things about finding out who your friends really are, you know. And I pretty much stopped at that point. My parents ran away from home when I was 17 and moved to Alabama. And it was a town of 2,000. They even had a room for me in the bay. It's on a lake. They always wanted to be in a lake, you know. But I said, no, nah, I'd rather move to 12th Street in downtown Atlanta than live on a lake in Alabama. You know, there's a little bit of decision-making issues going on already there, right? But I worked downtown, and I was working at I had a great job title. It was chief inserter. And I was in an office full of women in an insurance company, and what I did was run a machine that inserted mail into envelopes. I see there's some dirty minds out there, but I might be in the right place. But anyway, but I decided after working there and seeing all these people in their white-collar jobs sitting around with me, you know, not earning quite, I said, you know, it might not be a bad idea to get a college education. And so I went down and moved down to Alabama. Just before that, by the way, I did get arrested in Chambers County, Alabama at midnight. We were going down there, and it's the back roads back to the house, and we had had a beer or two. We weren't really heavy drinking, but the guy was driving, set the beer can on top of the car while we went to relieve ourselves over in the near the barbed wire on the side of the road, and the only car to come by was an unmarked car, and a guy pulled a pistol out, you know, and said, put your hands on the car. He didn't say anything about being a police or anything. Well, it turns out it was the sheriff, you know, going into work, just happened to spot us there. So I got indecent exposure and violating the prohibition laws of Chambers County, Alabama. I wrote a point. I said, last night I spent my time in Chambers County Jail with the gray bars of freezing steel and the busted radio whose poor unguarded fate it was to waste away in jail. And yet I think it funny that what occupied my time was laughter and an almost endless game of cards. And there were two guys in there for armed robbery and murder, and another guy in there for auto theft because he wanted to get back into prison with his girlfriend. So it was an interesting experience. But I got really no consequences. The guy driving the car got consequences. The guy in the back seat with me, when he emptied his pockets out, had a bunch of hash, and he wasn't even planning on smoking. He got the wrong pair of pants. So, you know, I don't know about you guys, but in a lot of ways, when I started off, I had a lot of fun and not that many consequences, you know. And then later on, in what happened to me is I really applied myself at that junior college I was going to, And my parents were real happy about that, and so they allowed me to go anywhere. And on a flip of a coin, I decided to, I called up the long distance information office, you know, used to, you know, in Colorado, and I said, what colleges you got there? And they said, Colorado State and Colorado. And I said, hold on. And I pulled a penny out of my pocket, flipped it, and it was Colorado State, so I applied and they accepted me. So that was my planning for higher education. So anyway, I went out there, and when I got there, it was the first kind of meeting they had at the dorms, and there was two ladies sitting on a couch, and I sort of butted in the conversation. Those of you who know me find that hard to believe, I bet. But coming October, we'll now have been married 35 years. So, and I think what it is she's just so bloody stubborn, she didn't want to admit she made a mistake during my drinking days. But I also introduced my roommate to the girl who was sitting next to her, and they got married 6 months before we did. You know, they've since divorced, and we're still married. I don't know why. I found out I can't take credit for the good things that have happened to me in my life, because I'd have to admit that I created me. You know, I used to think it was a mistake in the big book, the word creator, because I came in as an atheist. You see, when I was 15 years old, one of those hippies said to me, he said, you know, is it a coincidence you're a Christian in a Christian country? If it's the truth of the universe, why does it matter where you're born? Pretty interesting question for a 15-year-old. You know, if I was born in India, wouldn't I be Hindu or, you know, Islam or Sikh or something? So I began to look around. I remember sitting up on Kennesaw Mountain and trying to imagine the curve of the earth and thinking, wow, this is a big place, you know. And I was into wonder and awe back then too, you know. I really was about wanting to see. I was just trying to imagine what's on the other side of this thing, you know, and how big it really is. So I wound up doing my undergraduate degree in history with a specialty in India and China, and actually had a year of Chinese language. All I know really how to say right now is "wo bu wei shuo zhong guo hua," which means I don't know how to speak Chinese. Actually, a funny thing, when I came back to Georgia State and got my master's degree in business, they were telling me I needed my undergraduate degree. I finished it up there, and they said, "Oh, we have a problem. We can't test you in Chinese." I wouldn't have passed the test. It's been 2.5 years since I had it. I said, no, you have a problem. Yes, you do. And she said, wait, you've had Fortran. I said, that's a computer language. And they said, yeah, but it's spoken all over the world. So my undergraduate degree is in history, especially in India and China. My foreign language is Fortran. But right now, I mean, I can put on my resume that I'm capable of conversing with inanimate objects. So, So anyway, well, by the way, when I met my father-in-law, he's a cancer surgeon, now retired, and I met him, and I was long hair like this, riding my little Honda 125, the 60 miles from Fort Collins down to Denver, and he looked at me, and he sees that I'm taking Chinese history and philosophy, and he goes, what you gonna do with that? And I said, well, you know, I've always considered myself a Renaissance man. And he said, what the hell is that? And I said, well, you know, back in the Renaissance, you'd study cannonballs flying and write a book on it, and then go study ants for a while, you know, and be an expert, you know. And in some ways, that's kind of what my career has been. I've made myself an expert at being a generalist. And it turns out there's quite a niche for it, you know, I've in the different places I've worked. So I took a little bit of time off and didn't finish my degree there. And I worked for about a year and a half in a nursing home and got my nurse's aide pin. And I'll tell you what, that was an amazing experience to be around people who are looking back on 100 years of life and 75 years of marriage and to see what's really important. And I got to see what was important. Now, why the hell am I standing up here if I learned all that? Well, what happened is my wife and I got married in 79, and she wanted to come back here to Atlanta because she liked all the growth and everything that was here, and it was hard to get a job in her profession there. She's an occupational therapist. So we came back here and started our life here. And I finished up, got my master's degree, got very active doing things. I got a job working for a division of Equifax. Worked there for 12 years, you know, worked up, you know, began. But as I started getting, my son, by the way, was born in 84, and my daughter was born in 89. And then just around that time, right after he was born, you know, I'll tell you what, if you read in the big book, Bill talks about the varieties of religious experience by William James. Now, it's a book, if you want to read it, just remember it starts off like a cold car in winter, okay? Because he's going to spend a lot of time describing what he's not going to talk about. But as it starts warming up, it gets really warm. There's some neat gold in that book. But he starts talking about that one of the things that distinguishes a spiritual awakening is a shift from pessimism to optimism. And I did the reverse. I went from optimism to pessimism. I started looking what was wrong with my wife, what was wrong with my life, what was wrong with the world, what was wrong with my job. And then I had a guy was working for me, and he had a bachelor party, and we went to a belly dancing thing, and then we went to a strip joint. Now, this was a pull your pants down club that was a lot more adult than the one I was working at. And all of a sudden, I started, you know, I said, I kind of like this, you know, this, I'm, you know. And then I several weeks later, I was actually going to a place to get a massage, never had a massage, and then she offered the full treatment. And I accepted. But let me tell you what, this is about delusion, you know, it's not so much about denial. You know, denial is simply knowing the truth and being unwilling to tell it for fear of the negative consequences. You know, I can just change my mind and decide to come out with the truth. But if I'm in delusion, that's an alcoholic word. That is a psychotic thought in which the individual cannot tell the difference between fantasy and reality. Or what Clancy says is the mind, when faced with sufficient conflict, will alter its view of reality in order to resolve the conflict. So what did I do? I said, well, you know, in China and Japan, they got concubines. You know, and I justified that action. But I'll tell you what, I think Mama raised me better than that. And the guilt started kicking in, and I started drinking for effect. And not too long after that, I crossed the line. The guy who could drink just a half a beer during the 80s and do it regularly crossed the line. And I started sneaking my drinks. And I started getting the negative consequences. First of all, they were internal. You know, they were about a soul sickness, you know. I like the gal who said that she came into the program when she could no longer lower her standards to match her behavior, you know. And I got a good job working for HP. I was actually helping them build out data centers, but it was just progressing. I actually got a DUI 2 o'clock in the morning, pulled in front of a police officer with a half a fifth of Courvoisier underneath the seat of my car and another half in me. And I spent the night in jail again, but this time it wasn't about any laughing. When I came out, I was crying tears, and I swore I would never do that again. That lasted about 6 months. Because if I'm an alcoholic, alcohol's not my problem. You know, and I changed my mind about not drinking. You know, I get sort of like a pressure cooker, you know. I get a little bit restless, get a little bit irritable, a little bit discontent. Like, you know, that pressure builds up. Then I take that drink and, you know. Well, in April of 2001, I got put on probation because somebody had smelled alcohol in my breath around their multi-million dollars worth of equipment. And, of course, I denied it, but the first thing I did is I quit drinking. And you know what? I turned on the afterburner. And I was getting accolades left and right, and then the CEO of HP laid off everybody who was on probation, even though I was about to come off, didn't ask the managers or anything. And that's probably, you know, I look back, I have no regrets on that, you know. But I told him, I said, you know, I'm going to come back a year from now, and I'm going to be a millionaire. I tell you today that I am a millionaire many times over in an entirely different currency, you know. One that is just, there is no bounds to it. It's not like I'm dipping into a bucket. It's like I'm tapped into, you know, one of these fire hoses tapped into the Pacific Ocean, you know. It's an amazing thing we have here, and it is absolutely bottomless, what we have here. So I went through a whole series there of drinking, stopping drinking, drinking, stopping drinking, you know, through a whole series until it got to... I'd quit in September of 2003, got to be Thanksgiving, and I was over at my sister and brother-in-law's in Birmingham, and I made an excuse, and I got no excuses really because the family gets along great, everything. And I went down and got $300 we didn't really have out of the ATM. Drove all the way back by myself from Birmingham to Atlanta going, don't think about what you're doing. Don't la 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 la. Don't think about what you're doing. That's a long way to drive with that. Went over to the Mardi Gras, went over to a massage parlor. 5 days later, I had 105 degree temperature. And it suddenly broke, but then some very strange things started happening to my body, you know. I started passing gas and debris when I urinated, and there was just some very strange things happening. And that was in December of 03. And I quickly did something about it, and in February I went to the doctor. So if anybody catches that one. You know, how many times we sit there and just wish it away, just drink and wish. Yeah, I drank to forget, and I drank until I just couldn't anymore. Now, I drove over there, and I had to drink to drive. I was at the point I had to drink to drive. And they wanted me to take a pee test. Well, if they'd have found out I was drinking, you know, they did a little swab test thing. And that came out negative, which was, so now what the heck is going on, you know? But it was okay that I had a sexually transmitted disease, and I've been married 25 years, but it's not okay to know that I'm drinking and driving. Now, Bill talks about insanity as a lack of proportion when he talks about Jim putting the whiskey in the milk, you know? And isn't that true? This lack of proportion. My problems, wonderful, amazing world, and look at this tree, you know? My problems, look at life is all around, you know? And it's this way out of proportion thing that was so much about my disease. You see, my disease started out with negative opinions. Okay, and that's where I think we can sort of begin to blend into what happened in the traditions. You see, because in the first tradition, that tradition is, this principle behind it is unity, that our common welfare should come first. Personal recovery depends upon AA unity. I think a loneliest creature on earth just about is an alcoholic in our cups. You know, Chuck Chamberlain said that the ego is the conscious separation from. I was drinking a fifth of vodka a day. I was isolated in my house. Anybody here ever seen The Neverending Story? You remember The Neverending? And there was a nothing in The Neverending Story. And he said, what is the nothing? He says, well, if it was something, it would be something. And that's what I was in the house, you know. And my wife was baffled because I got pleasure by sneaking around. I smoked cigarettes for 8 to 10 years, and she didn't know it. Here I am connected. I should be connected with the woman who I'm living the rest of my life with. But total disconnection. So much of the traditions, that's the goal. The goal is about getting reconnected. With what? With life. I love this idea of Gaia, a living planet. You know, all one big living organism. There is no I. You know, there's just this one giant we. And when I can get connected there, that's where I find peace. That's where I really find serenity, and that separation is gone. So that's the goal. Unity is the goal. And I thought it was something that there was no way to get it. You know, I was lost. I always thought that my mind got me into trouble, my mind could always get me out of trouble. You know, and that was this deal. This is not thing. In fact, I really am beyond my beliefs. You know, there's something beyond those that has awakened as a result of this program. So what had happened is in July I got that letter from my wife, we may be losing the house and I'm gonna get another one, but you won't be invited unless something changes. So on August the 9th of 2004, I had my little leather bag that my wife gave me for one of those birthdays way back when, and I kept my whiskey in there and my cigarettes and some old Hustler and Club magazines I hadn't looked at in months, you know. I was really just, that's where I, this is the guy you're listening to right now. That's the guy I used to be. You see, it tells us we were reborn. And I can forgive that guy because he didn't know what he did. You know, forgive them for they know not what they do. I'm able in this program to forgive the guy I used to be. Because if I knew back then what I knew now, I doubt very seriously I would have done what I did. You know? So I quit, and I quit many times, like you heard, okay? But I had told my wife I was going to call behavioral services, okay, based on the ultimatum letter. So I had not called them. And it was one more lie. And I've been kicking on my own with still the crazy thing going on with my body. And Thursday night, that would be the 12th, at 3 o'clock in the morning, I'd had my 1 hour of sleep. Anybody been there? Try to go to sleep fighting the demons on the ceiling. Been there. Lonely. My wife's sleeping out on the couch. She's not sleeping around with me. And I got up, and I'd smoked my cigarette hanging my head out the bathroom window. You know, I think a great question for an alcoholic is, what would a grown-up do? You know, here I was, the same kind, acting the same way I did when I was back in that neighborhood, sneaking out of the windows at night, going roaming around the neighborhood, and here I was in my 40s doing that stuff, you know. So, and I knew at the time it was very dramatic, but I said the three-word prayer of an atheist. And I said it in the very depths of my soul, and I said, I need help. And I said, the first thing that came to me was, isn't this interesting, what's associated with the first step is honesty. I said, what am I going to tell her? I said, I need to tell the truth. Well, what am I going to start not lying about? And I said, everything. That morning I woke her up. I got my daughter off to school, and I woke her up, and I set her on the couch and said, I've been a son of a bitch. And I basically outlined it. Believe me, this is not in the book, but I knew nothing about the book. I just knew this. I couldn't live the way I was living anymore. I'm blessed with an amazingly strong woman. You know, in fact, she had to interrupt herself because she had to go to the bathroom. She'd been drinking herself to sleep too. You know, we have a ripple effect on the families, don't we? So I called behavioral services, and they said, oh, we can get you an appointment on August the 31st. I said, I don't think you understand. I've been drinking a fifth of vodka a day. You know, I don't know how long I can hold on. And they said, we'll call you back. So I also called the physical doctor because I had the physical thing going on, set up an appointment for Monday. The nurse calls me back and says, oh, we can get you in on Monday, but there was a conflict, so it was going to be Tuesday. So that weekend, I made a list of all the things that I needed to do that I had not done. It's kind of a curious, I gave it to my wife, it was 5 pages long, and she said, that certainly is a long list, you know. Well, I've still got the list, I pull it out every now and then. I haven't finished all of the things on that list, but a lot of them have been finished on that list. And I went to behavioral services, and I go in, and one of the things I had a lot of issues with was anxiety attacks. You know, my hands would shake so much, I'd have to get a drink to keep the shaking from going down so I could get to the ATM to punch my number in, to get my money out so I could get my medicine. See, when I finally went to that doctor, a doctor in May, just before all of this, and I finally told him what was going on. By the way, somebody said we should go to veterinarians because they're used to treating patients who won't tell them what's going on. And I finally told him what was going on, and he said, oh, you're self-medicating. Isn't that true? Self-medicating. I've got to change the way I feel, so I'm going to write the prescription. I'm going to go and get the stuff, and you know, I'm the knowledgeable one about what I need. And that was so much my sickness. So much of my sickness has to do with wanting to change the way I feel and acting on the way I feel. Ann Smith, Dr. Bob's wife, she had a journal she kept from 1933 to 1939. And in it is amazing thing. She says that feelings are the fruit, not the root of my faith. What that means is feelings are the physiological reaction of the body to a thought. And I don't even know what thought it is. And they have a machine to measure it called a lie detector. They hook you up and they ask you some questions, and my body senses a change. And then my mind senses the body having a change. And the body senses the mind. It's like holding a speaker up to a microphone. You know, what I got to do is I got to break the cycle. You know, what I need to do is just practice these principles in all our affairs. It doesn't say anything about reacting to our feelings in all our affairs. That's what I used to do. So you see, what I do is I act on principles, and at the end of the day, I can reach up and pluck the succulent fruit of a day well spent. I harvest my feelings today. I do not act upon them. Well, when I do, it doesn't go very well. You know? So I went in, and they gave me 14 pages of forms, and I've got a panic attack on 14 pages of forms. But I don't know where the willingness came from, folks. I worked with guys in the jail, and see them come in and out and in and out, and I've never been able to get the will. I got an overabundance of willingness, and I cannot give you a thimbleful of it. You know, but the willingness was there. It's the gift from God. What Bill called somebody said it was the X factor. He called it the grace of God. I cannot take credit for it. But I was willing to start off and just go, D, you know, and I'd love to have a copy of that form. Because it took me a long time, but at the end I was, you know, like this. And getting the psychiatrist, I told her everything. And anything else, well, I said, oh, I used to have a fear of filling out forms, but you guys solved that in one sitting. So it's a great treatment. You should add it to your repertoire. But and she said, well, can you see the behavioral counselor at 1:30 today? Well, here I am, a guy who used to have the laptop and the pager, back in the pager, and you know, the cell phones and all of this going off, and I'm demanded to go work at this data center and fly to Sao Paulo, and I got nothing. My calendar is clean, you know? And I went, yeah, I can go. And so I go over there, and I get in another 14 pages of forms, and I get back, and there's a guy, Joe Pringle, and he's the counselor, and he says, well, anything else? I said, well, I have a problem with this God thing. And he said, well, you know, I noticed you were reading The 7 Habits of Highly Effective People while you were drinking, which I just think is funny as hell. There was nothing highly effective about what I was doing. But in that book, they talk about a lot of things. But one of the things they talk about is natural laws. And he said, why don't you just treat this as natural laws? You know, these principles that we're about to, and you know what? They may be the most natural of all. You know, we still don't know why gravity works. You know, well, I can rely on it, you know. But I'll tell you what, I know that there are various spiritual axioms, like whenever I'm disturbed, there is something wrong with me. Or that we reap what we sow. These are natural laws. They're as dependable as gravity today for me. So I think I'm still taking that advice. You know, and I saw these books on Buddhism and all this stuff. This is the guy whose office I landed in. You know, there's God shots all in this thing. The first meeting I wound up going to that I found in Cobb County, I tried to find two meetings and couldn't find them. And I bought my big book over here. Has got a retail sticker on it because I bought it at Barnes & Noble. I couldn't find a damn meeting. So I wanted the stories in the book. And I had the little red one they give you, you know, but I'm an alcoholic. I want more, you know, about that. You know, so, but the guy, I know I've had the syllabuses, you know, at school and all that. I know you got to have this, so there's, you got to have a sponsor, okay. So, first guy I found in the first meeting in Cobb County raises his hand. I say, okay, you. Well, this guy hauled dirt for a living. That's what he did. And we go out in the parking lot. He says, well, do you believe in God? I said, no. He said, how about a power greater than yourself? I said, don't think so. He said, let me get this right. You're the most powerful thing in the universe? And I had to think about that. And I went, well, I guess not. He said, well, at least there's hope, you know? And he didn't know exactly what to do. But, you know, he said to me one time, he said, you know, I know of only one way to do this thing to help you out is to take you through the book, by the book. Thank God. You know? Thank God. He took me through the steps in November of 05. He called me up and said, I just had a heart attack. He said, don't worry about coming over. The ambulance is coming over. My family's going to meet me down there. But you know that guy you've been working with? You know, maybe try this and this out. Anyway, my son was over there. He said, who's that? And I told him what was going on. And my son went back to his apartment. And his roommate came out and said, my dad just had a heart attack. I said, what's his name? Steve Davis. My son and his son were roommates. Okay? This stuff happens to me all the time. It's been happening, and I'll tell you what, I'm an old, I did master's level statistics, and this stuff goes way off the bell curve. You know, I wind up, I call myself a retired atheist, because it got to be too much damn work to try and explain this stuff away, and I got too old for it. That's a good time to retire, when it's too much damn work and you get too old. Might as well just retire. And today I move in the presence of something I don't understand. You see, I was in doing all this. I was like the guy who went into the fancy restaurant, ordered the filet mignon, and ate the menu. and all of that schooling, I was reading all of these words, and I had no background, no personal experience on which to base it. As Chuck Chamberlain says, you can't see until you can see. You can't hear until you can hear. Hang around. If it's not there for you, hang around. You know, something, they say when an alcoholic drinks, something happens, you know. When an alcoholic dives into recovery, something happens. And that's the great mystery of this thing. Bill said that Alcoholics Anonymous is not a success story. Rather, it is a chronicle of our colossal human failures turned to usefulness by the divine alchemy of a loving God. And I can't explain it. See, I tried to find God in my understanding. I found God between my understanding. I wanted to feel what God was like, and I found God between my feelings. I found the thing that was watching my feelings, and the thing that watches my thoughts is that which awakens for me. And I thought it was unimportant. I thought it was a space where nothing happened, and it's where everything happens. The only thing I can really know is I am. See, my opinions are not facts. What's crazier? Every one of my facts is an opinion. Somebody, I was telling that to one of the guys I sponsored. He said, well, it rained the other day. I said, yeah, but was it good rain or bad rain? You know? Always attached to some fact, to some judgment, some opinion. You know? And so I love it when it says in the back of that book, right, when we realize we know only a little. You know? So I begin, I hear a CD, and I'm still struggling. By the way, when I talked to my sponsor about my wife and just complaining, he said, hold on, he said, how long did you drink alcoholically? And I said, I don't know, 10 years. He said, give her 10 years. I went, well, I mean, that's fair, you know, but it, you know, it's a long time. He said, well, she had a long time. She had to put up with it. You know, this August 10th, it'll be 10 years, you know. I think I'll give her another year. But I'll tell you what's happened is I told my wife, I said, do you have a new man? She said, no, I have the man I married back. You know, thank you. I can't express what that feels like. So I've got a few, these are, Dr. Bob said, you know, all any of us is looking for is happiness and peace of mind. He said, we all are after it. We're all after it in large measure. And he says, and we can all have it to, and he says, I've had it to a very large extent, but he says, there seem to be a few simple rules we need to follow. So let me go through these and see how this plays out. For a group purpose, there is but one ultimate authority, a loving God, as he may express himself in our group conscience. In my marriage, I'm not the authority. There's something else going on. You know, that's our group conscience. Our leaders are but trusted servants. They do not govern. I heard a misread I love. Our leaders are but twisted servants. They do not govern. And for me, I'm not governing, you know. My kids, I told my daughter one time, right after kind of adopting this, I said, I'm through being your father. I'm just going to be a resource. And she went, whew. You know, and she'll call me up and she says, because I'd heard something Father Joseph Martin said. He said, the best advice I can give you is don't give any advice. If I don't have the experience, I really don't know what I'm talking about. So she'll call me up and she says, Dad, I know you don't give any advice, but... And she goes and tells me something. And all I can say is, well, in a similar situation, I did this. I don't know if it applies. But this is what I do in similar situations. And that's all I can know. You know, I'm not governing. Oh, what a... Let me tell you about a load off my shoulders that I don't have to run the world. Oh, my goodness. That's great. The next one is the only requirement for AA membership is a desire to stop drinking. What if there were no rules for friendship? What if I have no rules for whether I'm going to let you be my friend or not? I want to meet everybody in Cobb County. That's what I just said. It's nothing against Cherokee. It's just I live in Cobb. And it's I kind of narrow the goals a little bit, you know. But I want to try and meet it. I find that through this program, when I lose those opinions, I can begin to do what love is, which is look for the good. You know, I love namaste, you know. The God in me sees the God in you, you know? And I go around, I meet all these spiritual people. It's almost like I got a neon sign going, spiritual, spiritual. You know, I'm just connecting up with them all over the place. No rules for friendship. Wouldn't that be great? You know? And I, but it, so each group should be autonomous except in matters affecting other groups array as a whole. When I send my wife out to get the groceries and she buys a different kind of tea than I was expecting, okay. It's autonomous, you know? She can run her life, I can run mine. I'm not trying to run hers. And whether she wants to try and run mine, I'm fine. You know, go ahead. I had whoever was running my life for a long time, I'd had my life in the hands of an idiot. That's what I had. So I'm okay with that. But that autonomy, you know, and my with my daughter, to let my daughter do her life. And I'm just going to be a resource again. That each group has but one primary purpose, to carry its message to the alcoholics who still suffers. What we have is we have a spiritual malady. And when the spiritual malady is overcome, we straighten out mentally and physically. What I can carry to my family is to be around them while I am experiencing the presence of God. That's really the message. The words are immaterial, you know, as long as the Spirit is there. Bill says we have entered the realm of the Spirit, you know, and that is so real to me today. Everything else is opinions. What you guys are thinking of me right now is largely theoretical. You know, in fact, you guys are largely theoretical. You know what I mean? From my perspective, it's all just a lot of opinions about what's going on. And I go, wow, that's a relief too. And then what I found out, I'm not the only one. It's not just me, you know. What a beauty there. That an AA group ought never endorse, finance, or lend the AA name to any related facility or outside enterprise. When I was working at HP, I'd lent my name to them. When I got laid off, it was like a part of me was gone. Not only a small part, a big part of me was gone. Because I had this pride in this job that I had. A lot of responsibility and all of that, you know. I don't want to lend my wellness to any outside circumstance. My mom, very spiritual woman, and I got a chance to be with her when she was dying of cancer, you know. And I had had this training in the work in the nursing home. Also, once I got sober in October or November of 2004, I started doing non-medical home health care, and I started treating people who in their own homes so their families could have a break. And I got to be with some amazing, I got some stories upon stories on that. And a chance to meet some amazing people. And it's, but so much of this is my well-being, the quality of my life has almost nothing to do with the circumstances of my life. It has everything to do with how I respond to the circumstances in my life, you know? And that's the magic of here. You guys taught me how to respond appropriately. And by the way, if you're interested, page 99 of the 12 and 12. It's the recipe for how to respond appropriately in life. Every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. And that for me is emotionally as well as financially. As you know, and I'm self-contained. I don't need the outside anything to validate who I am. Okay? It's not that I don't, that what you think of me is unimportant. It's unknowable. If what you think of me is unknowable, why should I be basing my actions on that? Now, what I think of you, for me, is life and death. Because I start thinking negative opinions about you and I can get restless, irritable, and discontent, and you know what that means. We all know that one. I need to remain forever non-professional. You know, this thing is not about giving advice, you know, or see, and a professional is someone who's into outcomes. Okay, you go to a doctor, you expect to get healed. You go to a lawyer, you expect to get your house back, you know, whatever. You know, non-professional says, I can tell you what I do in the process. And you can take it or leave it. It's up to you. You know, and I can do that in my own life. I try not to tell people what to do. I don't want to be responsible for other people's outcomes. Sometimes they've actually done what I suggested, and it didn't work very well at all. So sometimes people won't tell you everything you need to know. In fact, it's impossible to know everything you need to know to solve somebody else's problem. I think it's impossible. I might get lucky every now and then, just like monkeys throwing darts against a dartboard, and occasionally they'll hit the bullseye, you know, just from random chance. And those will mess you up, let me tell you. AA as such ought never be organized. you know, there is that spiritual realm that I'm in is not a place of organization. You know, that spiritual entity that, you know, it says we had to fully concede to our innermost selves that we were alcoholic. That place is not organized. It's not even in the place where that makes any sense. You know, now this body, the ego to me is a life support system for this thing I'm riding around in. It needs to be somewhat organized. It needs to get here in time. It needs to be able to set the stuff up, do all of that stuff. But that's not who I am. One guy says, you are what you believe. The question is, what you believe true? And I go, thank God that's not true. I'm much more than what I believe. You know, what today what I am is I am the awareness of what I believe. I might even be the awareness of the awareness of the awareness of what I believe. And it just keeps getting just neater and neater, you know, as we dive into that. This is the one that launched it all off for me was I should have no opinion on outside issues. How many times have you gotten in trouble because of your negative opinions? You know? How many times did I get in? So what I have done in the program is shift from pessimism to optimism. You see, any damn fool can be a, you know, critic. I don't think they've ever erected a statue to a critic in the history of mankind. You know? We've hung a few, chopped them and quartered them, you know. But I'll tell you what, I get calls from guys and they're just complaining about somebody. I say, hold on. Can you say 3 good things about that person? And if they can only get to 2, I say, okay, say 10. I call them spiritual push-ups. You see, love is look for the good. And what I decided to do is look for the good. And I've been finding out look for the awesome. Incredible. I love this little Indian yogi, he said. To know reality, you must be astonished. You know, this is amazing. I used to look at my hands when I was in middle school, and everybody said, oh, that's not bad. I'm back to looking at my hands. I mean, this thing called life. I mean, we must be some of the most amazing matter on this side of the universe. You know, and you know what, for the alcoholic? It was not enough. We were sending out probes trying to find something even fractionally like you. And we can't. Each and every one of you is perfectly you. There's nobody more perfectly you are than you are right now. This moment is perfectly this moment. And I said, well, what is that thing about claim and spiritual progress? And I realized the thing that wants to claim that perfection is the ego. And it can't because it didn't create it. I didn't create me. I can acknowledge that spiritual perfection and just acknowledge it and be in awe and wonder about it. And that's the beauty of these opinions. The quality of my life has so much to do with the quality of my opinions. And I can change them. I don't have to hop on every train that comes through the station. I can pick and choose today. You know, with 11, that our public relations policy is based on attraction rather than promotion. I like in the long form, it says, we prefer to have our friends recommend us. Isn't that a great deal? You know, to come here because a friend recommended that I talk to you guys. And you see, I didn't create me. And these concepts that I'm sharing with you are not anything I can take credit for. See, that's the ultimate of humility. I don't know how pride can take purchase in that soil. You know, the Chinese have a concept that has been translated into ancestor worship, but it's really not. You know, it's about honoring the ancestors and realizing how many ancestors do you have? Doesn't matter your belief, it's going to be one hell of a long string. And what did I do to help them survive to get nothing? So there's a freedom there. And then the very last one is that, and finally, we of Alcoholics Anonymous believe that this principle of anonymity has an immense spiritual significance. It reminds us that we are to place principles before personalities, that we're actually to practice a genuine humility. This to the end, that our great blessings may never spoil us, that we shall forever live in thankful contemplation of Him who presides over us all. Each and every one of these principles is a subtraction. It's a way of subtracting things in my life that are blocking me from number one, which is connecting with you, getting to know you, you know? Today I am a man most richly blessed, and I want to thank you all for letting me come here and share with your first speaker meeting. Thank you, and God bless.